Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump era of sleaze, which has brought us the pedophile Trump fixer George Nader, Trump's close friend and sex trafficker of underage girls Jeffrey Epstein, who was given a get-out-of-jail-free pass by Trump's Labor Secretary, and now Trump's most vocal supporter in the House, who Trump has lavished with praise, Matt Gaetz. According to the New York Times, Gaetz is alleged to be part of a sugar daddy ring of Florida politicians who use a dating site Seeking Arrangement to procure young women for sex using Apple Pay to compensate the underage girls, along with priming them with the mood-altering drug ecstasy. Jennifer Rogers, a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, who worked for the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, where she was the chief of the organized crime unit, and is now a legal analyst at CNN, where she has an article, Matt Gaetz's Diversionary Tactics Aren't Working, joins us. We'll discuss the growing likelihood Gaetz will be indicted soon on sex crime charges, sharing the fate of his friend Joel Greenberg, with whom Gaetz is alleged to have shared girls. And we'll also examine the difficulties that prosecutors now have, since much of the case has already been leaked to the press, with Gaetz himself having gone public on Fox with Tucker Carlson, incriminating himself and others. Then with the news that the Trump 2020 campaign used a money bomb fundraising scam to bilk his donors, we'll look into how Republicans are keeping Trump's Stop the Steal scam alive, through which he's fleecing his supporters of up to $500 million, which goes into his pocket and will likely be used to pay Trump's mounting legal bills. Joining us is Jim Small, editor-in-chief of the Arizona Mirror, where his latest article is Arizona Senate Hires a Stop the Steal Advocate to Lead 2020 Election Audit. We'll examine the QAnon follower put in charge of auditing the 2.1 million votes from Democrat-leaning Maricopa County by Arizona's far-right Republican Senate to find over 10,457 votes Biden won the state by, and the possibility that Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar helped plan the assault on the Capitol by providing insurrectionists with a tour of the Capitol in the days before the January 6th riot. Then finally, we will speak with Ryan Brown, a senior behavioral social scientist at the RAND Corporation who monitors internal and external security threats. He's the lead author of a new study, Violent Extremism in America, Interviews with Former Extremists and Their Families on Radicalization and De-Radicalization. With a second attack on the Capitol occurring on Friday, we will assess the likelihood of further attacks by domestic terrorists and what can be done to stop them. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Jennifer Rogers, a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, where she serves on the advisory board and was also the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity. Previously, she worked at the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, where she served in numerous capacities, including as deputy chief appellate attorney, the chief of the Organized Crime Unit, and chief of the General Crimes Unit. She's a legal analyst at CNN, where her latest article is Matt Gaetz's Diversionary Tactics Aren't Working. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Rogers.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it does seem that this Joel Greenberg character, who was indicted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Central Florida back in June, seems to be the reason why Matt Gaetz has been under investigation. And my understanding is that even though he was indicted back in June, just recently they've thrown a whole bunch more charges at him. And it looks as if both he and Matt Gaetz are tied up in this scheme, apparently, to pay money for sex through Cash App and Apple Pay, and they've been working through a website, which is for sort of sugar daddies, I guess, is what they call themselves. The website being Seeking Arrangement, which describes itself as a place where wealthy people find attractive companions to pamper them with fine dinners, exotic trips, and allowances. I must say, this era of Trump has been replete with sleaze, but the sleaze continues.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So, of course, we know Joel Greenberg was charged. He's been indicted. He's going to trial in June. So all of those allegations are out there. The Matt Gaetz allegations, of course, have leaked. We are being told there's an investigation, and it sounds like it did come out of the Greenberg investigation. It's been reported that Gaetz's investigation was reviewed by Bill Barr and was approved to continue, but we don't actually have charges in that case yet. So all of what's coming out now is leaking out, which of course is not ideal. It's pretty unfair for people to have to answer allegations that aren't even charged yet, but you know, here we are. He's a person of public interest, of course, and so people are talking about it. But if it proves to be true, if we do see charges, it does appear, if what's being investigated is what's being reported, that they kind of started looking at Joel Greenberg and then learned that Matt Gaetz was potentially involved in some of the same activity. And earlier in the week, we heard only about the travels with a 17-year-old girl. And then now what's being said, it sounds like there might be more involvement with some of Joel Greenberg's other activities. You mentioned the potential prosecution, paying for sex angle. It's being reported that Matt Gaetz may have even been involved in some of the identification document fraud that Greenberg has been charged with. And we heard either yesterday or the day before that it's being investigated whether or not Gaetz actually misused campaign funds. There are very strict rules around what you can do with campaign donations, and they have to be reported. All expenditures have to be reported to election authorities. So apparently that's part of the investigation too, whether he misused some of his campaign money in that way. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on, at least as is being reported in the media.
And I think you have to add to that, too, the possibility of using illegal drugs like ecstasy, which are also in the mix. So given that this was a leak, I spoke the other day with a veteran national security reporter who does the Spy Talk column, and he spent a lot of time talking with this Robert Kent character, the Air Force intelligence officer who was involved in what seems to be some kind of blackmail scheme with Gaetz' father, which, of course, Gaetz mentioned in a live interview with Tucker Carlson. And the supposition is that that's where the first leak came, that somehow this Air Force guy that was trying to get Bobby Levinson out of jail in Iran, even though it's widely believed that he's already dead, he must have heard something from the FBI, because he was able to tell Gaetz' father that, in fact, there were pictures of Gaetz with underage girls, or they referred to them as child prostitutes. I'm not sure that's even a viable term. But do you think that's where the leak came? Clearly, as you point out, it is troublesome. And I don't know whether it could get to the point where it could harm the actual case. Do you think it's that's a possibility?
Well, I have no idea where the leak came from. You know, there are very strict rules around releasing non-public information. Sometimes it gets out anyway. And what David McGee has said, and he's the lawyer that Matt Gaetz tagged on national television as the person, you know, one of the people at least behind the alleged extortion. What he said when he made his comments was, of course, I didn't extort anyone. This is all false. You know, everyone had heard, like, all I knew about this investigation into Matt Gaetz is what rumors were swirling. So, you know, I don't know how the leak actually ended up happening. But one thing that happens when things leak out is covert investigations are blown. So, you know, to the extent that Matt Gaetz and his father legitimately believed that they were being extorted, and Gaetz claimed that his father had wired up and had made a recorded conversation with attorney David McGee, and that there was another planned meeting coming up that he was supposed to record, you know, that investigation, of course, is blown. And so we'll really never know now whether, in fact, that was an extortion or whether it was something less than that, that they wanted to involve the Gateses to get money, but that they weren't actually being threatened with anything in exchange, because there was some suggestion that, in fact, what McGee and others were saying is, listen, if you put money into this and it comes out well and we bring Bob Levinson home, you know, Matt Gaetz will be a hero. He can ride home on the plane. It can look really great for him. And maybe that will help him with some of his troubles. And if it's cast that way, it probably is not actually a criminal extortion. So I don't know what that all would have maybe been, but that's one thing that happens when leaks happen, or in the case of Matt Gaetz, not even really a leak, but his just public exposure of what he said was an extortion. We'll now never know because we can't kind of see how that plays out and what evidence could have been collected.
Well, of course, yes, he blew it up in an interview, Matt Gaetz, with Tucker Carlson on Fox. He also, I think, put Tucker Carlson in an uncomfortable position, talking about the possibility that the same 17-year-old girl that's supposedly in this indictment that led to the possibility of sex trafficking charges against Matt Gaetz had a dinner at which Carlson was there with his wife. There's some suggestion that the reason why Tucker Carlson was so alarmed by that remark was that he was at this dinner, but not with his wife. So I guess we'll find out more about that. But do you think that in blowing up that FBI case, which he did, Matt Gaetz, is it also actionable what he said about the former U.S. attorney down there who was absolutely vehemently denied any suggestion that he's involved in this ridiculous scheme to get Bobby Levinson out of Iran?
Well, if you mean civilly liable,
McGee,
like,
yeah, in other words, yeah, more or less nailed McGee. Isn't it actionable what he said about him?
Could he sue? In other words, you're saying, yeah, could McGee sue for defamation? You know, I don't think so, you know, because to prove defamation, you know, he would say what Gaetz would say is that he believed that to be true. You know, he wasn't acting recklessly. In fact, he and his father had received his correspondence. They took it in a nefarious way. They went to the FBI about it, involved the FBI. So I think that their kind of pulling in the FBI demonstrates enough that they took this seriously as a potential extortion that he could argue, you know, that he believed that to be true. And so it wasn't him making a false statement as much as kind of expressing his belief. So, I mean, I'm not an expert in defamation law, but that seems to me something that probably if McGee tried to bring that case, he probably would not succeed in that. He's just going to have to continue to deny it. And as I said, now we'll never know. I mean, that extortion case is never going to be brought. It is going to go away. And he'll just continue to say, you know, I did nothing wrong, and hope that the attention diverts elsewhere. And it may. I mean, obviously now the attention is pretty fully on Matt Gaetz and what's coming out about the expansion of the criminal investigation against him. So McGee may have had his uncomfortable moments in the sun, and they may be over.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Rogers, who's a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, where she serves on the advisory board and was also the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity. Previously, she worked at the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, where she served in numerous capacities, including as Deputy Chief Appellate Attorney, the Chief of the Organized Crime Unit, and Chief of the General Crimes Unit. And she's a legal analyst at CNN, where her latest article is Matt Gaetz's Diversionary Tactics Aren't Working. Well, in terms of this Air Force guy involved in trying to get Bobby Levinson out, he's furious now. He's saying that Matt Gaetz, in his interview on Fox with Tucker Carlson, quote, he threw Levinson, the entire Levinson family, under the bus. I can't imagine what these poor people have been through. This guy, to divert attention from himself, has raked up the attention to the family. And McGee himself said, Gaetz is trying to distract attention from the pending tidal wave that is about to sink his ship. It seems as if Gaetz's Republican colleagues in the House are deserting the sinking ship, and apparently we are now learning that he was never very popular and that he'd been circulating pictures amongst his Republican colleagues on the Hill of him with naked young women, etc. At this point, there are only two members of the Congress seem to be supporting him, Jim Jordan, who is the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, He himself has got some hint of scandal, having apparently helped cover up the sexual activities of a Ohio State University wrestling coach that he worked for. And then, of course, the QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has come to Gates' defense. How do you see this thing? I mean, I guess we're waiting for the indictments that have been leaked to be made public. If you were on the inside, Jennifer, how would you feel about this, having all this publicity blow it up? What do you do in this situation? I mean, clearly they weren't ready to make the indictments, but aren't they being forced to do so now by public attention?
Well, to be clear, we haven't heard that there are indictments. We have heard that there's an investigation. So Greenberg was indicted without question. He's going to trial in June. What has leaked out is that the Greenberg case led investigators to Matt Gaetz, and that all the matters that we've been talking about are under investigation. So I have not heard that actually there's been an indictment. And almost always, as soon as an indictment is secured, the person is arrested and then the case becomes public. So I don't expect that an indictment is in place now. In terms of whether it kind of urges or hurries authorities along into making decisions and going to the grand jury for an indictment, you know, it does to some extent. I mean, they're not going to be rushed in terms of collecting the evidence that they need to collect, but it's all out in the public now. They've kind of lost the opportunity to have any sort of kind of covert actions, to approach witnesses who may not know what they're coming about or what they want to talk about now that this is all kind of blown up. So, you know, it may be that they do go ahead and try to wrap it up sooner. And frankly, that's fairer to him. You know, he is someone now who has all this swirling in the public realm. He hasn't yet been charged. It's fairest to him for them to go ahead and wrap up their investigation as expeditiously as they can and either charge him and make it public or not. And so, you know, we'll see, I think, probably fairly soon in the next month or so, which way it goes. You know, we'll just have to wait for that. And in the meantime, the political fallout, you know, Republicans tend to rally around their own for this sort of thing. They tend not to abandon them in the way that the Democrats have historically done. But I do think it speaks volumes, even though his colleagues are not coming out and publicly saying he should resign. You know, they are not rallying to his defense either, except for the two that you mentioned. So that does seem notable, but I think they're all going to wait. I think they're going to wait, see if he's charged, and kind of, you know, make their decision about what to do when they know which way that's going to fall.
Well, yes, it does. One does make the contrast with what's happening with the governor of New York, who seems to be sort of toughing it out. But many, many prominent Democrats have asked for him to step down. In the case of Gaetz, Kevin McCarthy, ostensibly his boss and minority leader of the House, said that there are serious implications. And if it's true, yes, we would remove him from House committees. But then he was asked about Gaetz being the only member of Congress to vote against the human trafficking bill, which is in itself an extraordinary thing. McCarthy said, well, I just don't understand why he did that. But just to a general question about the kind of people that have come forth during the Trump administration. Trump himself, of course, has, I don't know how many women have accused him of sexual assault and sexual harassment. You've had the most amazing characters. This guy, George Nader, who's at the heart of many of these shady deals with the Saudis and the Russians, and the Eric Prince of the mercenary outfit, Blackwater, secret meetings during the 2016 campaign. Is there something hear about the sleaze that seems to be commonplace, you know, not to mention Roger Stone, of course, at the heart of this. They're looking even looking into him about perhaps being behind organizing the January 6th assault on the Capitol. He's seen in pictures with both Matt Gaetz and Joel Greenberg. Am I making too much of this, or have we just gone into an era of sleaze under the former president?
Well, there's no question that the Trump era and administration was corrupt and criminal to a degree that we haven't ever known before. I mean, not even Nixon and Watergate approached the kind of amount of corruption and numbers of officials with those sorts of issues. And Roger Stone has been either in the middle of or at the periphery of a lot of different criminal activities. So it will be interesting to see whether he's charged again with something else. Of course, we know he was pardoned for his role in the WikiLeaks matter, but his involvement with some of the groups that brought coordinated groups of people to attack the Capitol is something that I am reportedly, at least told, is still under investigation. If he is close with and involved in any of the activities that Greenberg is charged with and Gates is being investigated for, they may have come across him in that regard. It's hard to say that because someone takes a selfie or has a picture with someone that that means that they would be associated in their devious acts. But Roger Stone certainly does seem to get around. So, no question that federal authorities would look closely at him as his name comes up and as he comes up in these things. And I would fully expect that if prosecutors get an opportunity to charge Roger Stone and have the evidence to do so, that they will do that for sure.
And in the sleaze mix, I forgot to mention, of course, Jeffrey Epstein, who was also obviously very close to Trump and certainly appeared in a number of videos and pictures, selfies or whatever they're called, along with the woman who's now in big trouble there with the Southern District of New York, right? The alleged
Yes,
procurer,
Ghislaine
Ghislaine
Maxwell
Maxwell,
is
right?
facing serious charges, and we'll obviously see her case go to trial sometime this year.
Well, thank you for wading through the sleaze with me. I'm sorry we have to talk about this, but it is obviously something that the public are interested in, and I thank you for joining us, Jennifer Rogers.
Thanks for having me. We will wait and see what happens. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about pretty soon here down the road.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Rogers, who's a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, where she serves on the advisory board and was also the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity. And previously, she worked at the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, where she served in numerous capacities, including as deputy chief appellate attorney and chief of the Organized Crime Unit, and as a chief of the General Crimes Unit. And she's a legal analyst at CNN, where her latest article is Matt Gaetz's Diversionary Tactics Aren't Working. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Republican state senators in Arizona are keeping Trump's Stop the Steal scam alive. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jim Small, the editor-in-chief of the Arizona Mirror, a nonprofit newsroom in Phoenix that covers state and local politics and government. A native Arizonan, he has covered state government policy and politics since 2004, and previously was the executive director and editor of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, as well as editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And his latest article at the Arizona Mirror is Arizona Senate Hires a Stop the Steal Advocate to Lead 2020 Election Audit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Small.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. I want to talk to you about what seems to be an attempt, I don't know whether it could ever work, of the Republican State Senate in Arizona to try to overturn the 10,000 vote victory that Biden had in the state by essentially hiring an advocate of the Stop the Steal to recount the 2.1 million votes. But before we get into that, can we talk a little bit about Representative Paul Gosar? I've heard from sources on the Hill that he's actually the guy that led, the congressman that led a delegation of people that were later showed up the following day on January the 6th to storm the Capitol, that he may have been the guy that brought the insiders in to case the Capitol. Have you heard anything to that effect?
You know, I haven't. I know that there's been a lot of speculation about, if that happened and if it did, who was involved with it. Certainly, I think he was very much involved in a lot of the pre-January 6th efforts to lie to voters, to inflame them to tell people, you know, hey, look, this is 1776, right? Like, we have to take up arms and we have to stop this from happening. He was the one who went onto the floor of the U.S. House and objected to Arizona's votes. He has been at the center of this thing the entire time. And you know, I think that there's little doubt that he has close ties to people who were involved, both directly and indirectly, in that attempted coup.
Well, one of the organizers of the insurrection is a guy called Ali Alexander, and he's gone public saying that Paul Gosar organized it with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Gosar, another Arizona representative named Andy Biggs, who's the leader of the House Freedom Caucus, and a Republican from Alabama named Mo Brooks are the ones that Ali Alexander has said were instrumental in kind of coming up, ginning up this whole movement and the protest and the rally and the whole thing. I mean, he is 100% up to his eyeballs in it, and I think that there's a reason that, you know, he and Biggs in particular asked Trump for pardons before he left office. They didn't get them, but they sought pardons. And I think that that's indicative of the fact that they fear that they might have some criminal liability and criminal exposure.
And of course, Representative Mo Brooks spoke at the rally that preceded the storming of the Capitol. Back in 2018, Paul Gosar's, or at least six of his brothers and sisters, I think there's more, but six of his brothers and sisters put out a commercial endorsing Gosar's opponent in the 2018 election. That in itself, I've seen that ad, it's pretty extraordinary. But what is even more extraordinary is, as far as I can tell, Jim, is that he still got elected. Where's his district? Is it in around Flagstaff?
No, his district is in basically the eastern, or excuse me, the western part of the state, kind of the northwestern part. And it is probably the most solidly Republican district. I think if it's not, it's the very close to the most solidly red district that we have. There is zero chance that a Democrat will get elected from that district. I mean, no matter what happened, regardless of what kind of scandal Paul Gosar gets into, if he's going to be voted out of office, it will be because he's beaten by a Republican, not by a Democrat.
Well, there is going to be another ad from members of Paul Gosar's family that's going to be played on Fox News in Gosar's district, I think, next week, right?
Yeah, there is. It's a I think that it's three of his siblings are in the video, and basically calling for him to be expelled from Congress and you know, subject to investigation and criminally prosecuted if the facts turn up that he did anything illegal with regards to that January 6th insurrection.
Yeah, apparently in the video, Tim Gosar says, the brother, or one of the brothers says, talking about his brother, the congressman, he should have criminal consequences, and if he's found guilty, he should go to jail. And then his sister, Jennifer Gosar, in this commercial, it's going to run next week on Fox News in Gosar's district, she says that there is no one member of Congress more responsible for the attack on the Capitol than Congressman Paul Gosar. So, pretty extraordinary, isn't it? It didn't work back in 2018, but you think it might work this time around to find a Republican challenger or?
No, I don't. I think that this is probably more than anything more about his brothers and sisters looking for, you know, ways to publicize exactly what their brother has been doing. And honestly, I know that they're airing it in the city where Representative Gosar lives, which is actually outside of his district. So I'm sure that part of that is honestly just kind of to troll him a little bit and just to make sure that he sees it and that his neighbors see it and that the people that are in his social circle see the ad.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Small, who's editor-in-chief of the Arizona Mirror, a nonprofit newsroom in Phoenix that covers state and local politics and government. A native Arizonan, he has covered state government policy and politics since 2004 and previously was the executive director and editor of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, as well as editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And his latest article at the Arizona Mirror is Arizona Senate Hires a Stop the Steal Advocate to Lead 2020 Election Audit. Well, just to finish up on Gosar, since the insurrection on January the 6th, Gosar spoke to a white nationalist event down in Florida. And earlier this year, he spoke to a white nationalist event in Florida. And then just last month, he tweeted out a message with the motto of a white nationalist organization. So he's not disguising the fact that he's a white nationalist, right? Would that make him the closest to a neo-Nazi in the United States Congress?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly has been really open with his views, and he'll chafe at the idea that, you know, of being called a racist or being called a white nationalist, but he also won't deny being called a white nationalist. And he certainly, I think, you know, has a years long history of having allies who are very active in the alt-right, in the white nationalist community, frankly, people who are outright bigots and racists. And those are the people that he views as his allies. And I think that says a lot about somebody, you know, regardless of what kind of protestations they make about whether they are or aren't a racist. You know, I think if you see someone who is constantly surrounding themselves with and appealing to those kinds of people, I don't think it's a very far leap at all to say, well, you know, they're in league with them and they share the same worldview. And I, you know, personally, I think that that's the case with Congressman Gosar. I mean, I don't think that there's really any doubt that he has become almost an out and out racist and bigot in a similar way to what like Steve King was, the Republican from Iowa, who was who Republicans turned on him after he made a couple of comments that were just beyond the pale that Republicans couldn't defend. I see Paul Gosar in a lot of ways, you know, kind of taking up the mantle that Steve King left and just being the congressman who's the most open about just associating with people who really should not have a place at the table in modern politics.
So, Jim Small, about your article in the Arizona Mirror, Arizona Senator hires a Stop the Steal advocate to lead 2020 election audit. The Senate President, Karen Fan, she selected this company out of Florida, run by this guy, Doug Logan. They're called Cyber Ninjas. And this Doug Logan character has been an advocate of the Stop the Steal movement. So he's hardly impartial. And in Arizona, in Maricopa County, well, in the state of Arizona, Biden defeated Trump by 10,457 votes. So what are they up to, hiring this partisan guy who's a nutcase, one of these obsessive characters that believe in the Stop the Steal, and he's been retweeting stuff from one of the characters whose father is alleged to be the founder, if you can say such a thing, of QAnon. Ron Watkins, the son, is a conspiracy theorist and former administrator of 8chan. And so we know what this character thinks. And he's also been obsessed with the role of Dominion voting. And Dominion, of course, is now suing everybody that's ruined their business model because they've clearly, with Fox News and Rudy Giuliani and that ridiculous lawyer, Sidney Powell, ranting on national television about this great conspiracy involving Dominion voting, which of course Dominion voting are, I believe, that were their machines were used in Maricopa County. So the long and the short of it is, Jim, I don't know why they're doing this, but is there any possibility that these nutcases can come up with alleged proof that Biden lost in Maricopa County and that somehow thousands more votes for Donald Trump? I think some of them have said there's up to 300,000 more votes for Donald Trump were somehow disappeared in Arizona. Is there any possibility that they could do any damage to the election results?
I don't think they could damage the actual election results, right? But I think that everyone should have every expectation that these people who are out and out proponents of, you know, discredited conspiracy theories are going to use the opportunity that they have now to bolster those conspiracy theories. And they're not going to do it because they're going to find actual proof. What they're going to find is they're going to find things that are normal in every election, things that are that they will then misrepresent, misinterpret, misunderstand, and they will put forth as though they are, there is something untoward that was happening or some kind of malfeasance that was happening. I mean, these are folks who, you know, this guy deleted his Twitter account back in January. The Senate this week announced that they were hiring them. Within an hour, I had found his deleted Twitter account and all of the tweets that he'd been posting in December and January, which were just rife with retweeting Sidney Powell, like interacting directly with Ron Watkins from 8chan, proclaiming that Dominion machines are switching votes, that they can't be trusted. This is a guy who is right now an expert witness in a lawsuit in Michigan alleging voter fraud on Dominion machines. He is signed on and signed an affidavit as someone who is who is swearing in court that these Dominion machines are switching votes, even though he's never examined them and has no experience with them. This is a guy who does not have a background in elections, does not have a background in voter, you know, registration or in voter database management, does not come from any of those worlds, is one of those people who spent a lot of time online and fancied themselves as some kind of an expert and put themselves out like that. And he is apparently, from what it seems like, he is bringing on other people of the same ilk who don't have any background in any of this, but is going to be bringing them on board to do things to audit the election, to try to find the fraud that they say exists. And, you know, I think when you hire someone who's going to approach something serious like an audit, and they already have predetermined conclusions and they've already, you know, made sweeping proclamations about what happened, and now you're asking them to evaluate the election, I think it's a no-brainer that they are going to present things that they find in a way that supports their what they've been saying all along. This is hardly an independent audit. This is hardly, right. You know, they did not hire anyone who's professional, who is unbiased. They hired, you know, this group of clowns to do this. And it's, you know, the stated goal from the Senate is that they want to restore confidence in the elections. Well, I promise you, what the people they hired will do nothing to restore confidence in the elections. What they're going to do is they're going to put out a bunch of half-truths and misunderstandings and misrepresentations, and they are going to make Arizonans and Americans in general trust elections even less than they do right now.
Right, but they will feed Trump's Stop the Steal. You know,
100%.
It's been Absolutely. Based on complete nonsense at any rate. But at least they'll have the fig leaf that this isn't the official Senate Judiciary Committee of the Senate of the state of Arizona, you know, which is in itself amazing that you'd have people elected that are that delusional. But just in closing here, Jim, given that Maricopa County has fought against these two senators, Fan and Peterson, and they've lost, obviously, what happens to the 2.1 million ballots from the 2020 election in Maricopa County? Who has custody of them now?
Well, right now, the county still has them. The Senate has insisted the whole time that they planned on doing their audit and doing all their work at the county's facilities. And the county has basically told them to go to hell and that they're not going to do that. And so they just at the end of this past week sent another letter to the Senate and said, hey, come pick up the ballots, guys. Like, you guys want them in court. You guys go take them somewhere else, because we're not going to let you use our facilities to perpetuate these lies that you guys are looking for. So figure it out. And so far, the Senate has no response to that. And I don't know when they will. I'm sure at some point, they're going to have to figure something out. I do not see a scenario right now where they come to some kind of an agreement with the county and the county decides to let them do it on their property.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this, because obviously the Stop the Steal lie, which Trump started with and has been pumping, this will breathe some life into it. And the real purpose, as far as I can see, for the Stop the Steal scam is that it's putting money in Trump's pocket, a lot of money, up to $500 million. And now maybe it'll all go to pay for lawsuits, but still, it is a massive scam in plain sight from the former grifter-in-chief. So I guess we'll stay tuned, Jim.
Yep. When we have more to report, I'm happy to come back on and talk to you about it.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with Jim Small, who's the editor-in-chief of the Arizona Mirror, a nonprofit newsroom in Phoenix that covers state and local politics and government. A native Arizona, he has covered state government policy and politics since 2004 and previously was the executive director and editor of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, as well as editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And his latest article at the Arizona Mirror is Arizona Senate Hires a Stop the Steal Advocate to Lead 2020 Election Audit. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Friday's second attack on the Capitol and the likelihood of further attacks by domestic terrorists and what can be done to stop them. JoJo was a man who thought he was a loner, but he knew it couldn't last. JoJo left his home in Tucson, Arizona, for some California grass. Get back to where you once belong. Get back to where you once belong. Get back, JoJo. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Brown, who's a senior behavioral social scientist at the RAND Corporation, focusing on improving the lives of rural and remote populations, assessment of special forces operations, urban American Indian health, and improving techniques of vetting, screening, and monitoring of internal and external national security threats. He co-directs the Center for Qualitative and Mixed Methods at RAND and is the lead author of a new study, Violent Extremism in America, Interviews with Former Extremists and Their Families on Radicalization and De-Radicalization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Brown.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And since the January the 6th attack on the Capitol, a number of congresspeople have suggested that that's the first of more attacks on the Capitol. And of course, on Friday, there was an attack from somebody who drove a car into a barrier and killed a policeman and wounded another. He himself was shot. Apparently, he's a follower of the Nation of Islam, of Louis Farrakhan, and believed that the CIA, he was a victim of CIA mind control. But is the report or the new study that you've done, Ryan, is that in a way to sort of work on the possibility that there are going to be more attacks like January the 6th and that we have to find ways to avert them?
Absolutely. So I think one of the drivers behind the report is the increasing acknowledgement that domestic extremism in the U.S. is on the rise. There was a swell in the 1990s, and now there's since 2010 or so, there has been another dramatic increase. And that's prompted the National Institutes of Justice to fund a variety of research projects to help understand what those pathways are. And you mentioned the second attacks on the Capitol. That really reflects one of the patterns we've seen in our research with the individuals we interviewed, both former extremists and their friends and family members. And that is that there's often some intersection of a mental health vulnerability, psychological distress, some, you know, non-standard information processing styles with propaganda that then creates the radicalization pathway. And both the January 6th attacks, had the propaganda element, conspiracy theories driving it. This was seemed to be more of a lone wolf attack, but it did seem to involve that toxic mix of some psychological or psychiatric vulnerability combined with beliefs that were partially augmented by extremist groups that are pushing out propaganda, and you could call it disinformation, but it's really propaganda that can be seductive for certain people.
Well, along with the mental health as a factor, which was mentioned in 17 of the 32 cases that you studied, there were also social factors like victimization, stigmatization, or marginalization. But it seems that the most common thread here is that people involved in migrating into radicalism usually suffered some traumatic or dramatic life event, such as, losing a job or something. So I think that is actually the case with this particular person who ran his car into the Capitol Police on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to to overstate the individual experiences as drivers, right? Because one of the things with this type of research, there's a retrospective bias. And so if you took 1,000 people who experienced traumatic events, you may not even get a single one who ends up joining a radical extremist group. It just happens to be one of the predisposing vulnerability factors. The pathways to coping and or healing could lead very, you know, many different ways from there. So the same goes for these experiences with traumatic, you know, like we call them reorienting events on the way to extremism. It turns out that these negative life events can also, or dramatic life events, surprises of various sorts can also be motivators to de-radicalize and re-examine one's investment in the group, particularly if that event challenges group membership in some way. So I do want to be, again, careful that these are not diagnostic criteria. They are certainly important elements, and they are taken advantage of. They're deliberately leveraged by these groups. They know what to look out for. Recruiters know what to look out for if they're looking for particular types of operatives. We've seen that with Islamic extremism as well in many different contexts. And propaganda is sort of designed, as well as these, you kind of see subtle social outreach. Come to this barbecue and, you know, see what white nationalism is all about. The initial emphasis is on providing the kind of psychological and social needs that are not, obviously not there in that individual's life. Then they feel welcomed, they feel protected, they feel part of something bigger and better. Now, in lone wolf attacks, sometimes that process occurs completely online. So they may be socially isolated, not have much face-to-face interaction, but the interactions online, the exposure to this higher purpose and the sense that you are really doing something important and good and fighting against evil can be seductive even without that face-to-face element.
So in terms of the study in general, you have the factors that lead an individual to join violent extremist organizations that you study are how and why do extremists become de-radicalized, leaving their organizations, changing their minds, and in some cases joining the fight against radicalization. And of the 32 cases that you studied, 24 were white supremacists, 8 females and 16 males, and 8 were Islamic extremists, 1 female and 7 males. So is there a symbiosis there between white nationalist extremists and Islamic extremists?
There are certainly a lot of shared patterns, and there seems to be a common substrate, social and psychological substrate. And what was really interesting is one of our partners, Parents for Peace, we were talking to them about the volume of calls they were getting over the last couple of years. All of our interviews were done pre-January 6th Capitol attacks, even pre-George Floyd. And on their helpline, they noticed after George Floyd's killing and the subsequent protests, they had a massive influx of calls from parents and other family members who were worried about radicalization to Antifa. So being pulled into street violence and other kinds of things that put their lives at risk. That switched after the 2020 election and the Stop the Steal movement to calls of family members who were concerned that their family members were being recruited to these right-wing causes. And so, you know, that speaks to the common kind of drivers that we see for both left and right-wing and Islamic extremist causes. In terms of symbiosis or them feeding on each other, it's this, you know, a similar kind of dynamic. Extremists need each other to keep feeding the patterns of violence, indignant rage, and the motivation to join. So we have fewer cases of where we see individuals joining, you know, equally likely to join any cause, because usually they're situated in a social network that makes them easier to find Islamic extremism versus left versus right wing extremism. But I think, you know, put in another social setting, the same individual might radicalize to a completely different cause.
So you mentioned the Justice Department. Did I get that right? being behind the study. Are there any other government departments that would be interesting? I mean, RAND's always been a think tank for the Air Force. Aren't they having some problems trying to purge white supremacists from their ranks?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this study was not explicitly focused on extremism in the military. We have been speaking with leaders from different service branches about this issue. They are trying to wrap their heads around what it is about the military that, both what it is about the military that can be appealing for extremist groups, but also what it is about extremist groups that can be appealing for members of the military or veterans. And we are very early on in our understanding of that phenomenon. We have been speaking with some former recruiters from right-wing extremist organizations who've described how the system of rank and military bearing and demeanor, and even in some cases uniforms, can be attractive to service members or to veterans, especially veterans who might be missing the experience of camaraderie or structure and mission-driven action. And we have a kind of the outline of a history of occasional involvement of service members and veterans in these groups. But I think we don't really know the extent of the phenomenon and where the weak points are in the military right now. And our kind of running hypothesis is that the really weak point in a pipeline, as we've seen for mental health and homelessness and other issues, is in that military to veteran transition period.
Well, you do mention the role of propaganda, and clearly that is a key to it, isn't it? I mean, you not only have propaganda. Well, let's take the case of, the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States. He has in many ways inspired the assault on the Capitol and the earlier assault on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 2018 that you mentioned as well in your study, in the sense that it was Donald Trump that kept talking about these caravans coming up from Central America, and this person attacked the synagogue because the synagogue, the Tree of Life, was about protecting and supporting immigrants. So What role does it take a powerful public figure like the President of the United States in combination with propaganda, which we certainly have? We have pro-Trump propaganda in terms of the media like Fox and others, but you also have this extraordinary conduit for disinformation and radicalization and propaganda on the internet. So are all those factors in the mix?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it was kind of a perfect storm. And certainly political leaders and leaders in popular culture and elsewhere can be catalyzing factors, as we saw here, and they are often also wittingly or unwittingly echoing themes that our foreign adversaries would like to see featured prominently. So I think, it's the ability of information to travel quickly, and I've heard you say on your show, the post-truth era, difficulty in ascertaining fact versus fiction, which, was really augmented by the COVID pandemic as well. I think when we look at kind of a post hoc, review of what happened with the Capitol attacks, and we get more and more evidence on what the COVID lockdowns did to human psychology, I think individuals were longing for some sort of, we're missing a lot of normal social interactions. And so that created some predisposing components as well. But absolutely, when you have political leaders or leaders from popular culture or elsewhere parodying or mimicking or even coming up with their own creative conspiracy theory content and certainly encouraging others to act, that really can form a toxic mix. And it really, in the Capitol attacks of January 6th, we saw, people coming out of the woodworks. As often happens with extremism, family members are surprised, they're caught off guard. But this, it really seemed to catalyze a lot of bubbling sympathies that created an extremely dangerous insurrection. So sometimes all of these things can converge in extremely dangerous ways, and it's hard to get ahead of or anticipate when that will happen.
But just in the last few minutes, to get a handle on what can be done in terms of prevention in the future, since it's very much this, your study is really about, it takes the position, which we discussed in the beginning, that there are going to be more attacks, and we saw another one on Friday. So one of the things you mention here is that punitive interventions by law enforcement often led to paradoxical effects of increased extremism. So what are the methods that you can identify to nip this thing in the bud, or at least head it off before it turns really violent?
Yeah, so I've heard another RAND researcher, Brian Jackson, describe it as our current approach to de-radicalization and certainly prevention of radicalization is kind of a retail model. So we have examples of organizations and individuals who have pulled others out, who are good at small-scale interventions, but we have not really found an ability to scale this up to a wholesale model. And what I'm thinking of in particular is our de-radicalization narratives seem to always feature, or very frequently feature, unexpected and surprising friendly treatment by hated groups, exposure to diversity in which kindness and empathy is shown and is really needed in that moment because the individual's down on their luck or confused or really needs a job or has some other kind of basic human need. And sometimes that's set up intentionally. So we have Arna Michaelis, for example, works for Parents for Peace and sets up these encounters with like gang intervention organizations and really kind of finds individuals who are good at creating those experiences of kindness and really carefully titrates that into the lives of extremists. But those are kind of custom fit interventions. And if we're able to scale that up, maybe starting in schools, building social fabric and exposure to diversity in very human ways, not in pedantic ways, but real, really deep human experience. I think we have, some opportunities to really get ahead of this pipeline. At the same time, some of these plots are being caught late in the game, and we can't ignore that there is a role for some surveillance and intelligence. It just has to be used very carefully and selectively, because what we saw with the war on terror too is that over-monitoring, overly aggressive surveillance, that can really push individuals away. And if you feel like your enemy is the state, that just gives you more evidence that the state is your enemy and is pursuing you, and your actions are justified if you're intent on some sort of an assault on infrastructure or individuals. So it's, I hate to say it's complicated, but it is, it's going to require, I think, intervention at multiple levels and some continuation of the, not necessarily punitive, but the detection and interdiction side of things will continue to be important.
But just in the last couple of minutes, this belief that's pervasive amongst white nationalists and the QAnon types is this idea of the deep state. Is there any sort of cognitive recognition that the deep state certainly failed us on January the 6th, right?
Yeah. Oh, you mean amongst these groups, is there a recognition?
Yeah, in other words, the idea that they were able to storm the Capitol in the way that they did, it was just so extraordinary, and there was so little preparation, so little coordination, so much for the infamous deep state.
Right, right. Yeah, that's an interesting, I don't know the sort of, internal chatter well enough amongst these groups. There are people who follow this, really closely. But I think there may have been a kind of unexpected rebound effect there. Number one, the assault looked kind of disorganized and embarrassing when viewed, through television cameras. A number of people were arrested and faced consequences. And so I think, I don't know if it was a recognition that the deep state maybe isn't this giant behemoth with, omnipotent arms, or it was a combination of that and a realization that it was, not that difficult to accomplish what they did. But that's a very interesting hypothesis, and I think it would take an expert in the sort of day to day and week to week propaganda of those organizations to assess that. But it's highly plausible.
Well, Ryan Brown, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Brown, who's a senior behavioral social scientist at the RAND Corporation, focusing on improving the lives of rural and remote populations, assessment of special forces operations, urban American health, Indian health, and improving techniques for vetting, screening, and monitoring of internal and external national security threats. He co-directs the Center for Qualitative and Mixed Methods at RAND and is the lead author of a new study, Violent Extremism in America, Interviews with Former Extremists and Their Families on Radicalization and De-Radicalization. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.